From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. Let's open the week with a conversation that many women told us men need to hear. You might have heard the story of Molly Tibbetts, a University of Iowa student who was abducted while she was out for a jog. Tibbetts was murdered.
Runner's World magazine surveyed women and found that a majority of women who run have been harassed. Many will not run at night. Many formulate safety plans in case they get attacked. In this clip, you'll hear Eva Petrosino, a communications professional and an avid runner. But first, you'll hear our WXXI colleague and also an avid runner, Lisa Familetti.
My experiences have kind of been all over from people, you know, giving the honk to people rolling down their windows and saying something to you. I was just talking earlier about an experience that I had a couple years ago. I used to live over in the East Ave area. And so one day I went running in the afternoon down East Ave, thinking nothing of it. And I got stopped at a light waiting to cross. And these two gentlemen have their windows down and they're hooting, hollering at me. And I know that they're talking about me because they're pointing right at me and they're yelling out the window. And I'm super uncomfortable. And they're also talking to me in Spanish. So I don't know Spanish. And I don't know what they're saying to me. So God only knows what they're saying. And then it's like, so do I ignore them, which I choose to do, and they keep going? Or do I respond some way? And that's going to have them keep going too. And it just makes you feel super uncomfortable. And this is like broad daylight. It was probably like 4:30 in the afternoon, and it's super uncomfortable. But then there's other concerns too. It's, what time of day am I going to go running? Like I was talking about this morning, woke up at 6 a.m. and it's dark out. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to go running this morning at 6 a.m. like on my own. I'd have to wait until 6:30 when it's light out, cut my route down, or go later today when it's still light and I feel comfortable. I know so many women who I've talked to, even if we go in groups, we're like, we should go still when it's light out. And you also have to take the normal safety precautions if you run in the dark using reflectors or flashers or something of that nature. But it's just a constant thing. And I go running on the canal, and you have to be aware of your surroundings. Are people going to pop out from you here? And also, too, if you do go running in certain areas, if I got hurt or if somebody is following me, where can I run to? Where can I go to? Are there houses? Is there a public place nearby? These are all thoughts that are a normal occurrence when I go running on my own.
Eva, let's talk about your experiences.
So I run in the dark all the time. I have two little kids, and they dictate my schedule and when I can work out and when I can do things that I want to do. So because of that, I most often will run after bedtime, after I put them down to sleep, which is like 7, 7:30, 8 o'clock. We have our routine and we stick to that. And similarly, my running routine is like that too. So 7:30 or 8 o'clock, when I set out for my run, if it's dark, I wear my protective stuff, my reflective or my flashing belt or armband or whatever. But those thoughts are always in my head of, what am I going to do if someone comes up on me? What am I going to do if this happens? I always have that next step. So much to the point that, like, I've planned out several scenarios in my, what if it's this? What if somebody just comes up to me and just startles me? Well, I need to have, like, a defensive position that I take. Or what if somebody actually, like, touches me and, like, grabs me? Then I'm going to do this. I've thought about ways to leave evidence behind and, like,
wow.
It, like, really in-depth stuff, Evan.
Wow.
I live in the suburbs. I mean, I live in a great neighborhood. You know, lots of kids, streetlights, you know, the typical, you know, American dream, you could say. But do I feel uncomfortable? Yes. Every time I go out for a run, there are people mowing lawns or people, whatever, driving into their, in parking in their driveways and stuff like that. There is one stretch of my street that I will no longer run down because one of my neighbors, I mean, a little ways away from my house, they will just stand in their driveway and stare at me while I pass by them. And that just, like, it just gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit because why are you watching me? I always run faster by that house if I have to go that way because it gives me like an uncomfortable feeling.
Next, a new study finds that American Christians are growing more judgmental and less forgiving. The study finds that nearly half of American Christians don't think it's their responsibility to show mercy to those in need.
Local faith leaders were disappointed to hear that. Here's Pastor Chris Holdridge of New City Fellowship in Rochester, who is not afraid to be blunt.
I'm sorry he feels judged, but the reality is this is the wealthiest country on the face of the earth. And we buy so much stuff that we don't need. And I don't know what his personal giving is. I don't know, maybe he's feeling challenged in his personal giving, but I do know that many people who give to efforts like ours, I think, have a mentality that the dollar they give, you know, we throw it in the air and it turns into $10. You know, actually the dollar that they give has to get split 100 different ways. And we're constantly trying to figure out how to split it most effectively in the ministries and with the people that we're working with. And so, you know, a mentor of mine, you know, told me one time, you know, do the math with your budget, figure out how much you can give, and then give 50% more, and you'll be where Jesus wants you to be. So I am challenging particularly evangelical Christians to think more holistically about their spending and their consumerism and what they value.
So let me just follow that to put a point on it. You said people buy things they don't need. If Andrew, and I don't want to speak for Andrew, the emailer, but if someone like Andrew were to say, well, who are you to judge what I need?
Well, it depends on, I mean, we could get into the weeds and talk about exactly what's being spent, but who am I? I'm a minister of the gospel, and I've been ordained to gospel ministry, and I have a job to do, and that's to challenge people to give more, to be more faithful to the call of Christ in their lives, to suffer more, and to be more biblical in their living. So that's who I am.
Next, Liberty University found itself in a national controversy recently. Student journalists were told they could not write certain stories about Donald Trump for the campus newspaper, and university president Jerry Falwell Jr. wanted to shut down other stories that he didn't like. Falwell told the students that their job is not to conduct journalism, but to burnish the reputation of their school. We wanted to talk to students and staff at local college newspapers about what they're learning about journalism and how to respond to threats.
In this clip, you'll hear from the director of the School of Communication at RIT, Andrea Hickerson. First, though, you'll hear Taylor Gothy, an RIT student who runs the opinion section of the student newspaper.
I think the difference between a free press and one that's being controlled by administration is the ability to say no. Because I've written many controversial articles. I'm the views editor. I talk about the opinions, and some things get a little salty at times. But the difference is that I have the ability to say no. When someone asks, can I read your article ahead of time before it's published, I have the right to say no, and I always say no. And I think the biggest issue isn't whether they're going to try it, because the administration is going to try to see if they can have some control in publications. That's a very regular occurrence in reporters, just to read recordings, to read our notes, to read the articles before they publish. But reporter has always had the ability to say no. And honestly, the day they say I can't say no anymore is the day I started underground newspaper. Because if we don't have a free press under the school, we'll create a free press somewhere else.
That's a bigger and a more important point than we may initially take it. You might take it as sort of a flippant remark, but I think the effort to censor generally backfires. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask all of our guests if they agree, because I'm looking at this Liberty University story. It's a national story now that mm-hmm. people are sharing and reading about this university whose president is firing people, telling them your job is to do PR, their communications, the College of Communications, which helps advise the papers, telling them, I know you think you're there to do journalism, but you're there to do PR. You know, it's become a national story, mm-hmm. whereas you let them publish some stories they may not like, but it's not a national story. So I think if you started an underground paper, it'd probably be more popular even than The Reporter, maybe. Do you agree, Taylor?
I feel underground papers have a lot of use, but one of the best things about being part of the university mm-hmm. and having them fund our newspaper is that we have the access and resources to publish it on a
Fair
server
point, too.
And share it throughout the magazines and have stands, right? And I do agree with you that universities need to understand that having a free student journalism is to their interest, because it attracts more journalism majors, it attracts more readers and audience to the university, and also provides transparency, because it always looks more dirty when you try to cover it up instead of just admitting the mess that's already there. And I believe that Reporter is very good at having us talk about the controversial stories. We're really good at criticizing RIT, and RIT is very humble receiving criticism from us.
You agree with that, Andrea?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, RIT really respects the student voices there and who the audience for the reporter is in the RIT community. And I think that if they ever were in a difficult situation, they would find a lot of allies amongst the faculty. And I totally agree with Taylor's point that to be, even though in Liberty's case and actually in all the cases we're talking about private universities, the law actually is on the side of these universities because they give resources to them. There is a legal standard that says that they could do that if they wanted to, but I think it would totally backfire, which I think is what makes the Liberty case fairly unique because they don't really care, right? So they have this very consistent ideological point of view that they are more interested in getting out than really fostering a free press and giving people an opportunity to practice journalism as it should be practiced, and that is mostly practiced in the real world.
We'll end the week on the subject of job shaming. Former Cosby Show actor Jeffrey Owens was recently spotted bagging groceries at a Trader Joe's in New Jersey. Owens was ridiculed for it, but he responded by saying that all jobs have value and dignity, and he's just trying to get by.
We welcomed a panel to discuss their own experiences being shamed. In this clip, you'll hear Scott Fitzgerald, who once worked for a Fortune 500 company, before quitting.
I was working for a very large cruise line. I grew up in South Florida, so I was working in Miami. And that was a very difficult job, burned me out over about almost 5 years, emotionally and not physically, but emotionally and mentally just drained. So I left that job and went outside of my career, which was video production at the time, and started working for my brother and doing other odd jobs just so I can pay my bills. But I was ridiculed. Now, this is before the internet was really, or at least before social media, internet was around. But so when people shamed me, it was almost to my face or through a third party.
What
so
would they say?
They would just say, "What are you doing? Why aren't you working in your field right now?" And it's not like I was planning on, oh, I'm just throwing away my experience. I'm going to just do whatever. I really needed to regroup mentally from the abuse, I call it, that I underwent at my job just because of the work environment. And when I went and started doing this, I slept better. It was hard work. But let me tell you, I was more fulfilled and I had less stress and fewer worries.
Working construction
because I knew what I had to do for the day. I went in and I did it. It was hard work. It felt good to have that kind of exercise. The other job, I was at a desk working with unrealistic deadlines with a boss who really, really put us through the mental wringer. I mean, he really did a number on us because we're all young guys just out of school, just starting out. So they kind of felt like they could, you know, take advantage of us. Oh, yeah, this is your first salary job, so you got to put in the hours. You're going to work 60, 70 hours a week. That's just how it is. And when I got out of that, it was so freeing. And I was happy. I didn't care that I was pushing a broom and digging ditches and stuff like that. It was fine. I was helping build something.
And so you said people commonly would say, "What are you doing? Why are you not using?"
Yeah.
Was there also a tinge that there's something less than in construction?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, how do you talk to those people, those guys that you work with? You know, the guys swinging a hammer all day. How do you talk to those guys? Like they can't have an intellectual conversation. I mean, some of the best conversations I ever had while working was on a construction site. You know, talking politics, talking philosophy. We talked about all kinds of stuff. It was mentally stimulating. It was refreshing. And it was something that I didn't expect. I mean, I grew up in that environment, you know, helping my dad as a little kid and stuff like that, but you don't pay attention. But when I actually started doing that and didn't worry about the stigma that went along with it, because some of the guys that I work with at the other place, you know, they're like, "Oh, well, some of those construction guys are kind of goofy, or they've got no ambition. They don't, you know," and I'm thinking, do you know what this guy can do with a hammer? He could build an entire house. What can you build? You know, it was fascinating. And they totally glazed. They didn't even see that part of it.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370 from noon to 2. Also from noon to 2. It's always from noon to 2.
Yes.
Sort of weird construction of words there. I'm there. AM 1370, where else? RUR, which is 88.5 FM. It is FM. It's on 88.5 AM. That'd be weird. And WEOS. 89.5 FM, Finger Lakes Public Radio. What else?
The WXXI mobile app.
You do it.
He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We will talk to you Monday.
Bye.